This is an ABC podcast.
In 1937, Hubert Opperman rode his bicycle from Fremantle to Sydney. He did it in a record-breaking time of 13 days, 10 hours and 11 minutes. Much of the route was just rutted tracks, and at times Hubert had to carry his bike through soft sand in the searing heat. He'd sleep for 10 minutes or so at a time and was so exhausted that sometimes he fell asleep while riding and crashed his bike. 80 years on from this epic ride, a group of 70 cyclists aged from 18 to 74 set off from the South Mole Lighthouse in Fremantle in Hubert's wake. Among them was Rupert Guinness, a sports journalist who'd been writing about cycling for more than 30 years. But the inaugural Indian Pacific Wheel Race was Rupert's first endurance race. Tragically, that 2017 race ended with the death of English cyclist Mike Hall. And like all the other riders, Rupert was left asking himself some big questions about the sport of cycling and what it meant to him and his family. Hi, Rupert.
Hi.
Do you remember how you first heard about this new race, the Indian Wheel Pacific Wheel Race?
Yeah, it was like most big things in people's lives, it was by chance. I just finished writing a manuscript for another book written on the history of Aussie cycling, and there was this chapter of these cyclists called the Overlanders, and they were cyclists back in the 1890s who went on these great expeditions across inland Australia and around Australia.
Well, how early did people start cycling in Australia?
Well, it was probably around about the late 1870s that the bicycle sort of came to Australia. At the time, it was becoming very popular around the world as well. In Australia, obviously such a large country, but it was so unpopulated at the time, and there's only a few spotted cities around the country, and it was otherwise gold mining towns or some rural properties or outposts. So the bicycle became a really popular form of transport. As apart to having horses or camels, you didn't have to feed a bicycle. The bicycle was, you could just leave it against the wall and they were pretty sturdy.
It wouldn't run off?
No, they wouldn't run off. You didn't have to, well, I was about to say you didn't have to name them, but people do name their bicycles now. It was really a form of transport, really. In the cities, it was a form of transport, but also a recreation to go, around the parks and things like that. But for these overlander riders, they very much took the bicycle to the next level from not just being a form of transport, but actually sort of discovering a lot of the interior of the country. And they just followed camel pad tracks that were already left there by, the camels, obviously, or teamsters. And they just sort of plotted a large part of Australia, and a lot of the road networks that exist today were impacted by these overlander cyclists.
And who was the first person to cycle all the way?
Arthur Richardson was the first person, and he set off from Perth, and incredible, still amazing when you think of how he did it. And he was very much the sort of the face of this overlander breed of cyclist. He was also the first person to ride across the Nullarbor in 1896. He went from Coolgardie, the gold mining town, to Adelaide. So he was the first to make that. That was like one of the first sort of overlander routes broken. So I thought the Overlander would be a great story in itself for another book. And then no sooner did I send this manuscript into the publisher for the history book that suddenly I saw this ad saying, is the Overlander in you? Do you want to do this race called the Indian Pacific Wheel Race? And I immediately took the bait, and there I was plotting and planning as to how I could do this race.
So it was scheduled to start on the 80th anniversary of Hubert Opperman's ride from Fremantle to Sydney. How important a figure is he in early Australian cycling?
Oh, he's a massive figure. Like when he did his Cross Australia ride, and it was a different route than the Indian Pacific route, but he's an iconic figure of Australian cycling and Australia in many ways too, because he was a federal parliamentarian. And he was, with Oppie, he was known as a road cyclist, he was known as a track cyclist, and then he was also became an overlander for these routes that he took. And, the route that he took across Australia was, as you just describing it then, it still shake your head when you think of the terrain that he went across. And Because when I rode it, obviously I saw terrain which was harsh, but at least we had bitumen roads. And I was left wondering so many times, you just look across to the desert and I'd say, how do these guys do this? I just still don't understand how they did it.
He had an agent who on that ride around Australia tricked him into thinking he'd had more sleep than he'd had. What's the story?
Yeah, his agent, Bruce Small. And he, him and Bruce, well, Bruce Small, you know, he created the Malvern Star Bicycle Company, which was iconic as well. And Oppie became, you know, the person or the face of the Malvern Star bike. And Bruce, very, you know, him and Bruce were very much a team in themselves. Oppie did the riding, Bruce did the organising, managing, and all around the world they went together. And anyway, on this ride, Oppie's getting a bit weary and he's getting a bit wobbly, and he's saying he really needs a break. He's saying, "Oh, Bruce, man, I need to have a break, you know. I'm falling asleep here." And then Bruce sort of says, "Okay, Oppie, mate, you can have 8 hours sleep." And so Oppie puts his head down, goes to sleep, and then Bruce winds his clock forward 7 hours and 50 minutes, and then just taps him on the shoulder and goes, "Oppie, you've just had your sleep. Wake up. And Oppie just immediately just gets up.
After 10 minutes.
He's had 10 minutes sleep, the poor bloke. Anyway, but Oppie didn't know this at the time. And then Oppie gets up and starts riding again. And then afterwards, you know, Bruce is watching Oppie and he's swerving across the road and looking a bit ragged. And that's when he realises, oh, perhaps I've overstepped the mark here. But and Oppie was asked, you know, he was told he was going a bit wobbly. And Oppie's saying, "No, it's not me, it's all the other cyclists." But there's Oppie on his own in the middle of Australia. So you talk about hallucination. And so, but obviously he made the route and he made it safely. But it shows the sort of the power of the mind. Also the power of an agent as well.
So you knew this history of early cyclists, you know, endurance cyclists in Australia, but had you ever done a race of this kind of length before?
No. I hadn't ridden, the longest ride I think I'd ridden before then would have been maybe 220 kilometres, you know. So day one of this race, I'd already did 326, and I thought, my gosh, I haven't even ridden that before, and I've got to do this every day. I was going to try and do 300 every day, but I quickly reevaluated what I was capable of.
So what was the appeal then, Rupert? Something so out of your experience, out of your comfort zone?
Yeah, it's still a question which I still, even, you know, still a question I sort of think about now, but what, I mean, obviously the first, that there was the lure of this challenge, you know, an opportunity to do something that I hadn't done before. And I've had a tendency to do that before in the past, like with the Sydney to Hobart yacht race. I did that twice, but the first time I didn't, I hadn't actually, I'd been on a yacht just around Sydney Harbour drinking gin and tonics, but this was going out and, you know, and I got, anyway, I did that. So I have a tendency to sort of drop into these sort of things, and I just like the sense of adventure. And I do believe that, in our lives, we're not actually tested and challenged enough. I'm not saying you have to go out there and get punished, but I think we're inherently, we've got these survival skills or these, you know, strengths within us that can be certainly be better used than what they are for a lot of people. And if the opportunity comes to try and find out how far down I can take on whatever challenge it is, I just have a curiosity to find out what I have in me.
So you'd done open water sailing. Mm. Was there other endurance sports that you'd,
yeah,
that you'd part in?
When I was young, I very much, you know, steered towards endurance sports rather than ball sports. You know, I was never really, at school, I was never really the one that was good at the cool sports, you know. I was the one who was all right at the endurance sports that people say, why would you do that? You know, there's an easier sport to, well, I'm not saying easier, but, you know, I was never good at cricket, never good at basketball. I tried them all.
Cricket feels like an endurance sport to me, as a viewer.
If you sit through 5 days, yeah, and it's a draw. But I think, you know, even in rugby, I was quite good at rugby, but the only position I ever played was tight head prop. And in those days, the tight head props never got the ball. I was the last person to have the ball. And if I did, there was a mistake in the game plan. So I was never good at those sort of ball sports. So I steered towards, I did rowing, and I was pretty good at rowing, and then triathlon and cycling, and then I did marathon running, and then obviously then led towards these other sort of sports.
What did your wife Libby think about you signing on to do this race?
gee, Look, if she was listening now, she'd probably be calling in soon. But, I mean, I think she was, I think at first she thought, oh, there's another one of Rupert's sort of ideas. And then and then she quickly cottoned on that I was quite serious about it. Sure, she was, you know, she had concerns about the safety element of it, and obviously the inherent risk is you can, as what unfortunately did happen, you can get have it be in a collision and lose your life. But saying that, she was, like, she used to do ocean racing herself in sailing, and so when I did the Sydney to Hobart, you know, she really embraced that really quickly, and she was great to give me advice on how to best serve the crew, which was basically don't get in the way, which is a simple but a very good piece of advice. And so she got her head around that very easily. With the cycling element, obviously there's the fear of traffic, and you know, she has trust in as to how I conduct myself, but you're never going to be guaranteed that you know what can happen on the road. Unfortunately, it can happen in the city as well. And so it took a lot of discussion, put it that way, for the first and the second time.
The Indy Pack is an unsupported race. What does that mean?
It's a solo and unsupported. So while we all started together at the same time, you ride off from the start, and then first rule is you're not allowed to ride in packs or ride in the slipstream of one another, you know, to give each other assistance. You can ride next to somebody, that's allowed, because there's obviously, as the field splits up over the first days, there are times when you cross paths with people. So that's the solo element, and the start is at the start, and the finish is 5,500 kilometres later in Sydney, and you've got to stick to the route. And the unsupported element is you're not allowed to have access to any resources others can't get to.
What if someone offers you a drink along the road?
There's a grey area in this. See, there is a law that allows for what they call trail angels or road angels. You know, some people may just come out and leave an esky full of drinks with a sign saying for Indy Pack. Oh, Indy Pack's the anachronism for the race. They say drinks for Indy Pack riders, and so you're allowed to help yourself to those. Originally for the first race, officially, if someone came up and said, "Here, do you want some water?" You're not meant to take it. You were supposed to look after your own food and water supplies yourself. If you set off at the day, you've got to be responsible for what drinks you've got on board, or you have to purchase them or attain them through like a tap in the side of the wall, because everyone can get that. But if somebody comes up to you, technically you're not meant to take the water.
And what was the prize for winning the inaugural Indy Pack?
Nothing. Not even a medal, not a finish, forget the finish, not even a winner's T-shirt, is it?
It's nothing. A bit rough, isn't it?
Yeah, but I guess you probably needed a T-shirt too by the end, because what you do need is something clean to wear. So
so this isn't about the money or about
Definitely not. And the people who are at the front end of these type of races, because there are races like this around the world, I mean, they're phenomenal athletes, and their mental attributes are also just as strong as their physical attributes, but they have a passion for this style of racing, bike touring or bike packing, however you call it, they definitely don't do it for the T-shirt or for the prize money or the medal. Definitely not.
What kind of training did you do in the lead-up to this, Rupert?
Yeah, it was interesting because I pretty much had a blank canvas of how to do it, because I hadn't experienced this type of riding, let alone racing, before. So at the time, I was already cycling quite a lot with my cycling club, Eastern Suburbs in Sydney, and so we have structured squad sessions during the week, and then we have club rides on the weekend. Did all that. So basically, what I started doing, increasing my kilometres in the weekends, for example, and then during the week also getting out far earlier than, like, normally the club would meet at 5 or 5.30, but then I'd start going on rides at about 3 o'clock.
Why is that?
To try and get used to riding in the dark and alone. And a lot of my early morning rides in the dark, in Sydney, probably one of the darkest places in Sydney, near where I live, which is in Edgecliff in the Eastern Suburbs, is Centennial Park. And because it's kind of blocked from the ambient light from the CBD, and it's secure and safe as far as traffic. So I thought, it's just to acclimatise to the darkness and the loneliness. And while it was a long, so different to the, say, the Nullarbor Plain, there were some kind of scary moments, because you go into the middle of a inner city park in the dark and your mind starts, you let your imagination go. You start thinking of crazy things like you don't know who's going to suddenly run out if there is somebody.
Different sort of dangers in the inner city,
definitely, yeah.
And how much stuff were you going to carry on your bike and where?
Yeah, that was the really hard part. I found this element harder than, say, the actual training, because the training is, you know, it's just training. But knowing what to put on your bike and how much to take, because I read a lot on the internet, I read books, I asked people, I spoke to people, and I had all these bits of well-intended advice, but I didn't have any real filter on which to gauge which was the best advice or not for me, because I hadn't experienced it. So I basically probably went out and started buying everything. I got these boxes of gadgets, which I haven't even used, some of them. They're still at home, sitting and, you know, waiting for future adventures. So I was online shopping, and all these, you know, these periods of weeks, parcels would arrive with this gadget.
More
that gadget.
Lycra. More gadgets.
Yeah, more gadgets, GPS systems.
So what made the final cut?
Basically, I took one load over to Perth or to Fremantle with me, and then I had to do a culling of that. And then I remember the night before, I was still packing my packs on my bike, and the instigator of the race, Jesse Carlson, who's a great athlete in this type of racing as well, he went past me twice. You know, he could see me trying to pack my bag, my packs, you know, shoving things in and taking them out, and it's like the night before this event, and I hadn't even had dinner at this point, because he told me later, he's told me since, that he remembers he saw me there, and he felt like stepping in to say, you don't need that, don't need this, and he felt like helping me out here, but he thought that's not part of the experience. The experience is finding out what you didn't need, and then being like 600 kilometres down the road thinking, I needed this thing, you know, so he just left me to learn by experience. I'm grateful for that, because it wouldn't have been the same if he had just said, this is how I pack my bag, this is all you need.
You don't need the egg timer.
And it is solo and unsupported. And the solo and unsupported element starts from the moment you enter and prepare.
Well, when you were at Fremantle, why did you pay a visit to the ocean before you set off?
Well, one of the traditions of the overlanders was to, particularly if you're on coast-to-coast rides, is to dip your rear wheel in one ocean, in this case the Indian Ocean, and then when you get to the finish, you dip the front wheel into the other ocean, in this case the Pacific. So that's what we did down at Bathers Bay, just near the South Mole Lighthouse at Fremantle. I think we all did it. We didn't all do it at once. We did it sort of the same part of the day. And it's quite a simple thing to do, but it's actually quite a special touch, you know, and it's great to see people still do that now, you know, and in other rides today. And it's great that, you know, one of the things ostensibly about this event, as you said, was to pay homage to Oppie and his ride in 1937, but also to resuscitate this history and legend of the Overlander rider, which very much got forgotten in Australian history, because I think it's more than just a sports history. I think it's a part of Australian history, and so these sort of touches of traditions like this are really poignant parts of the experience.
So the morning comes for you to set off, Rupert. What was going through your mind? Did you feel ready?
No. No. I remember thinking, because the night before, because after all, you know, when I finally decided everything's packed, and I didn't really have much sleep. I went to the bathroom, and then I heard. I was reassured to hear other people still up. I thought, well, it's not just me who hasn't slept. You know, I could hear other people sort of shuffling
zipping
around
and unzipping.
Yeah. And this was like at about 3:34 in the morning, and then, you know, the race is going to start at 6, and the start line's about a kilometre and a half away. And then I remember hearing Sarah Hammond. She was in her room, and she was she's a great racer in this too. And she was still, I could hear her, you know, fluffing around with papers and things. I remember going, oh, that's good, it's not just me, you know. And then I later heard that, you know, Mike Hall, who we mentioned before, he only had 1 hour of sleep because he was fluffing around trying to get things.
Is that because you're full of adrenaline?
I think so, yeah. And I think it's this sense of, gee, you're about to go on this big adventure. You know, you're leaving from this point. You know, this is the last good night's sleep I'll have, even though it was a crap night's sleep. But it was, this is the last, you know, contained environment I'll be in. And then just pre-event nerves, like you would have, you know, sort of similar nerves to what I've had before an Ironman triathlon and everything. You know, have you got everything ready or not? And you realize,
did you have everything ready?
No. No, and because one of the things I really didn't have ready, when I set off, actually, I remember it was just raining lightly, and I remember thinking, I could do anything today but this. I really didn't want to.
It was like a, day one.
Day one, thinking, I already think I don't want to do this, but I thought, don't think this too much, just roll the bike to the start and just go. But it was just before the start, I remember I didn't have my my spot device, which was like the GPS tracking system, and you have to activate it, and it's a really important device because you also have there's like three special buttons on the device for safety and security. You know, one is for it to start, and I hadn't really practiced that enough too. And I remember just before the start asking another guy called Ryan Flynn, mate, can you get my spot device going? How do you? And he just pressed a button and he goes, there you go. I went, oh, thank you. You know, and the rest I thought I'll figure that out later. But the other has a start button, and then there's, if you're in trouble, it's got a button for if you're a life or death situation, you can press a button and it'll go to satellite and it'll bring a, you know, helicopter to evacuate you if you need it, at a cost, obviously, but if it's going to save your life. There's another button which, you know, if you need assistance, but you may have to wait there for 4 or 5 hours, but like a truck or a car may come out and pick you up. And the other one is when you get to the end of the day or where you're going to stop and have a sleep, you'll press it and activate a message that'll go to a select number of people you've put on the device who will receive this message saying, hi, this is where I'm staying tonight. All's good.
So this is an important piece of tech for you to have working.
Yes, and because we're all on these on the dot tracking system too, so people can follow our GPS through the GPS can follow our dots going across the country. So that one's the really important one for friends and family to know that you're okay.
So a friend helped you with that, and you were sorted. You set off. Where were you heading that first day? Did you know?
I didn't know where I was going to end up. I knew I was heading east. Nearly said west. Back in the
ocean.
It's
a short ride.
Back into the ocean. Back to the dipping my front wheel back into the wrong ocean. But
so you didn't have it set out in that, you know, each day I'm going to aim for this particular spot.
My rough plan was to try and average 300 kilometres a day. Then I figured I could get around 3 weeks to finish it. As I said before, the first day I did 326, and I got to the town of Meriden. And I was pretty busted by the end of that day. But I was also, I didn't eat enough during the day, consistently during the day. Number one rule in cycling, and I've written in stories when professional cyclists have what you call hunger flat. And, you say this is the number one mistake, dumb mistake for professionals to make. You know, it's not a good mistake to make. And here I was making the same mistake on day one.
You did stop for something to eat in the afternoon on that day, and you ran into an Australian cycling great, Rod Evans. Mm. What did he give you?
Yeah, we're in the town of Bruce Rock, which was about 80 k's before Meriden, and that was a point where I started to get really hungry. But anyway, so I saw Bruce turned up in his car, and he had a chat to a couple of us, and there was three of us who were at that place, and then he came. The others sort of left, and then he came across to me, and he said, "Oh, Rupert, I just got something for you." And he pulled out of his pocket a little envelope, and it says, "You know, on it, you know, open, and if you think going gets tough," he said, "Here, just in case, if you think you're going to pull the pin or something, just open this first before you do make any decisions." And I said, "Oh, yeah, thanks, Bruce. That's very nice." And he said. It's just a cup, just a note or two, but and I'm thinking, I wonder what's in there. But anyway, I folded up and put it into one of my little pockets just near my handlebars, and it was just folded in there. So I knew that was going to be, if I was going to pull the pin, that would be my last act before I did pull the pin.
So you rode 300 or so K that first day. What was the first thing you did when you got into the hotel room that night?
Oh, look, the first thing I felt like doing was just collapsing on my bed, you know, rolling, you know, going to sleep. But then one of the bits of advice that I had, and I've always stuck with it since, you know, your first thought is what you want to do is to have a shower, apart from falling asleep or lying on the bed, have a shower. But really, the first thing you want to do while you still have some senses around you is to pull out all the things from your pockets, take your all your electric and gizmos, plug them in to recharge them, like your lights, your GPS tracking devices, my drink bottles. I refill them straight away, put them all on the plate, my food.
What's the importance of doing that straight off before you have a shower or a sleep?
It just makes, they're the essentials that you need to get going the next day. So if you do that now, like when you finish before your rest, everything will be in place, ready to go for when you wake up. And when you wake up, you know, you can forget to do things, and you may forget to, you may suddenly realize, oh, I forgot to recharge my lights, I forgot to recharge my computer. And you may get down the road, oh, I forgot to refill my drink bottles. If you do it all that night, before you give yourself the luxury of a shower or a sleep or a feed, you're ready to go the next day. And you've got through that process. And if you do that every day, it becomes a systematic process. So it's a really good, simple exercise. But if you don't do it, it can really ruin your next day.
What physical shape were you in day one?
I wouldn't say I was in physical shape. It was like what I wasn't in, but I was certainly really tired. And I remember I went and got some food, and I got really fatigued later, and I got hunger flat and the shivers in bed. So I needed to turn the lights out.
Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
Rupert, were you in this race to win it, or was it just to survive it in these early stretches?
Yeah, Sarah, when I started, I went in there with a race mentality. Now, I remember that was one of the questions Jesse Carlson, the instigator, he asked me when I was speaking to him beforehand. He said, "You're going to go with the race mentality or you're going to ride it?" And I said, "I'm going to race it, Jesse, you know." But I didn't think I was going to win it. But very quickly I realised, look, if I just finish this thing, that's going to be more than an achievement to be happy with. So I had to reevaluate that pretty quick.
Were there riders who really were out in the lead straight from the beginning?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the first day, like I said, I got to Meriden and I did 326 Ks. I think the first day some people, they got further than Southern Cross. They were close to like 600 kilometres on the first, 450 to 600 kilometres down the road. And quickly that gap blew out over the next few days incredibly. It was astounding the way that they were riding. And
who were those top riders?
It was guys like Christophe Algert from Belgium, and there was Mike Hall, obviously. There was a bunch of other Europeans, and from Australia, there was Jesse Carlson was up there early, although he had to pull out on day two because he had a medical condition from a previous race that sort of flared up again.
And they were able to make those distances because of speed, but I guess not sleeping as much. That must be the way to do it.
Yeah, rather than sort of high intense, well, it was much more intense. They were racing much more intensely than I was, but for them, they don't go for the intensity. They just go for the duration, just to continue on. Another person was Sarah Hammond, who I mentioned before. She was like a serious contender for the win. You know, it's actually, from a racing point of view, it's kind of it's an event where it's not gender-specific. You know, that's one of the great things about the event, too. It's really the people out there racing. And like she was doing, like, I think 450 kilometres a day, and just consistently riding at a set tempo and not wasting time at stops.
What kind of relationship did you have with the other riders, Rupert? Did you see them as rivals?
No, definitely not. Even the night before in Fremantle, you know, there was a reception where we all got together and we realised this was probably the last time most of us would meet each other. It could be the last time we see each other, except for the next day. But there was a natural sort of spirit amongst everybody. And then even, you know, like when you get to the other end of the race, however it pans out for everybody, everybody still is following each other's story on the social media and on the tracking system. And even since then, you know, I've remained had very good contacts with a lot of people. you know, developed a lot of friendships. So
how does that compare, like, with the sort of road racing you've covered, like Tour de France?
Oh, it's a complete antithesis to, you know, the Tour de France to say, the Indy Pack. I mean, the Tour de France is obviously the biggest bike race in the world. It's the most marketed race. It's, you know, it's the title that every professional wants. Or not every, it's the one title that every professional dreams of at least winning. And you've got the money, you've got the crowds, you've got the business side of it, you've got the intensity of shorter stages, obviously, racing in packs, tight roads, dangerous roads, everybody's tense. You could argue everyone's angry because there's so much, it's so cutthroat from a competitive point of view. Then ostensibly through that you get issues like the corruption, the doping, the whatever's good and bad about professional sport. You get it all crunched in a real intense level, whereas a bike pack racing, it's very much tapped into the purity of cycling. While it's still a competition or a race for the top end riders, and they are racing, they are trying to win the race, but they still maintain, they still got their finger to the pulse of what's great about cycling, the purity of it, the adventure, the essence, that the thing that all gets us to ride bikes from when we were just kids. They still don't let go of that, you know. And I think at professional cycling, that gets lost. I can understand why, but it does.
You talked about how you really needed to eat and keep on eating. What would you eat when you'd stop at a servo or roadhouse?
Oh, it's the worst possible diet. It's disgusting.
I'm imagining, you know, healthy juices and sort of protein balls and...
No, that's one of the ironies of the whole thing. Because I remember part of my preparation, I lost a lot of weight, you know, and I was really good with my diet, and I learned how to eat and eat well in general life, and I started losing weight. Of course, I was concerned about not losing too much weight, because one of the rules, you've got to carry your own food. So if you've got a bit of fat on you before, it's actually good to carry it on your body rather than having to find other places to put it. But you lose that very quickly. And the amount of food you eat in a day, and at these roadhouses, with all due respect, there's some great roadhouses out there. And if they're listening here, I've had great service, great burgers. But hamburgers, breakfast, lunch and dinner and all that, it does get over the top. And then we'll be eating chips, hamburgers, chocolate bars, and in no specific order. Sometimes I'd have, when I wake up in my little room, my first breakfast would be what's left over from yesterday's ride, which would be a couple of chocolate bars and an old muffin, and then I'd go and have my normal breakfast.
You're just eating like a teenage boy, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, if you want to relive those days, you can do it.
Was that sort of disgusting after you've worked so hard and riding so hard to just pull into a servo and just cram down hamburgers and chips and soft drink?
I certainly lost... I didn't see food as food. It was just fuel. It was just about shoving something down your throat to eat, and it really I did lose my taste. That was one thing I did.
What do you mean?
Well, like, I couldn't taste the difference between chocolate and a hamburger in the end, you know, particularly when I finished the ride this year, you know, because I was there for, you know, I couldn't taste the difference. I just shove it down my throat and eat it. And even with, I take food with me, you know, normally you'd be thinking you've got a sandwich, you try and put it nicely in your pocket. Well, to fit more in, I just crunched all the sandwiches up into a ball. Like, I take two sandwiches, just crunch up into a tight ball, and then shove it into my pocket, and then just pull it out when I need it. And it wasn't a nicely cut sandwich. It was just a ball of mush that's been warmed by the desert sun. And you think, oh, God, I have to eat this. Here we go.
What was your favourite time of day to be riding?
Oh, well, look, the favourite time of day, the most beautiful emotive moment was just before dawn.
What's that like?
Oh, it's fabulous. Like, I didn't realise how beautiful country Australia really is. But you need to get out into the desert. As harsh as the desert is in the middle of the day, those hours before dawn, like, I'd get up early in the morning. I'd always try and finish my day earlier and then get up earlier, and then so I'd ride from like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, sometimes from midnight, but usually 2 or 3 or 4. But those 2 or 3 hours before dawn, you know, one moment you're riding and it's in total blackness around you. You know, you can't tell the difference between the blackness of the land and the road to the sky, except for you've got lights on your bike, obviously. Although one time I did stop and turn the lights off in the middle of, because I wanted to know how dark it was, and it was like someone just put a hand over my eyes, you know. But when you get closer to dawn, you start to notice just in the horizon, the blackness is going to a very dark blue. And it's just this very, and you know that's obviously sunrise coming. And I, you know, thought of it as like nature's movie. I'm going to see a rerun of nature's movie every day for 27 days, you know, and it's like watching your favourite, out there it was like watching the favourite movie 27 days in a row. And it was just beautiful because you see just incrementally that blue go from a real dark blue to a lighter blue, you know, and then suddenly you'd see the first little simmer of redness, which was obviously the sun coming up. It was just like a slither in the horizon, and then it would be turning a little bit of a shape of a ball just rising, and you were just mesmerised by watching it, and it was all for free, and it was just you. It's like sitting in a cinema by yourself, but much better than a cinema.
And what sounds would you hear out there when you were riding by yourself?
Well, and what I loved about pre-dawn and dawn was, people talk about the quietness of dawn. I mean, it really is a real special quietness, and you'd hear, you know, because you've got the sense of how small you are in this vast landscape. But then you'd hear, like, the first thing you'd hear would be this bird, like this, and you knew it was a very small bird because the tweet was such a, it's like a, you wouldn't hear the tweet of this sort of bird if you lived in the city because there's too much noise, even in dawn. And you'd hear this first little tweet, and then hear another little tweet, and then you'd wonder, obviously these little birds are living in these little shrubs. So for them, that's their big house. But and then suddenly this cacophony of tweets, and then it was that would be the first thing you'd hear. And it was beautiful, really was beautiful. And it was really soothing to the spirit. And then you're still very cold, though, too. And then there is a point where you're thinking, oh, come on, sun, just a bit quicker now. And then you get that first warmth that just sort of goes over you. And it's like, you know, if you're cold and you jump back into bed in the winter's morning, is this what that first spritz of sunshine over you is like? And it really is, one, it's physically beautiful to feel the sun, but it's emotionally a fabulous experience.
What about traffic, Rupert? What's it like when one of those massive road trains passes you?
Yeah, look, there, that can be really daunting. And I think you do have to be prepared, you know, to engage with that experience for sure. But it doesn't have to be an intimidating one. It can be a frightening one, but if you're prepared well enough and if you give yourself time to allow for
can
it.
Can you hear them coming in the distance?
You can. It's really important to have a good mirror on your handlebars, for starters, so you can see them coming up from behind, because you can't keep spending your whole time looking over your shoulder like you may do riding around the city or in pelotons with your local club. Because if you keep doing that, you're just going to do yourself a neck injury. And if you keep looking around, you're not going to be seeing what's in front. You've got to have a really good mirror. But you can see them coming up from behind. You've also got to be aware of them coming from in front, because particularly when there's two road trains going past and they cross over with each other, there's so little room on the road. Basically, it's wise to stop. You know this is going to come, just stop. You're not going to, you know, you've got a whole day to ride and you want to be safe and you just got to stop. But what I would do, I'd see a road train coming up and I'd get to a point where you can hear them, and then I'd put my right arm up to signal I can see you coming. Personally, I had a great experience with the road trains.
How long is, once you get to the start of the Nullarbor, how long is the road across the Nullarbor?
Well, the actual Nullarbor itself, see, this is another thing I didn't really calculate. I just used to think, oh, the Nullarbor, you know. I never really dawned on me to actually check exactly how far is it. So, and funny enough, I only checked on that this year. It took me two times to cross it to figure that one out.
Surely one of those gadgets you'd ordered online could have given you that information.
At this point, there was still one gadget I still hadn't figured, which was another gadget, a Garmin E-Trex 30. I still hadn't figured this one. But the Nullarbor sort of starts after the town of Norseman, and then it sort of finishes in Ceduna. So it's about 1,000 kilometres.
Just straight the whole way?
There's one particular straight, which is like 146 kilometres, and there's a famous signpost there where everyone stops because it's the longest, straightest stretch of road in Australia, if not the Southern Hemisphere. And everyone stops there with smiling fingers, thumbs up, here we go. I can tell you what, the smiles and the thumbs up change pretty quickly. After the first 500 metres, you go, oh, my gosh, this is straight.
What's so hard about the Nullarbor?
I think there's various elements. One, it can be the wind. If the wind's, you know, headwind and crosswind, you're so exposed on the Nullarbor. And we had a lot of that. And also because you're so exposed once in the middle of the day with the sun, you know, it's you are exposed to the heat and just the whole bit, the elements of it. There's very little shade there. And there are elements where there are some trees where you can find shade, but it's still so hot. The March flies are terrible. You know, they just bite.
They're while you're cycling?
Well, if you stop, you've got about 30 seconds to do what you want to get done, whether it's a natural break or to do something, whatever you need, just do it quick, because the March flies will come from every direction and latch onto you. And then even when you start cycling, they're still sort of got their teeth or whatever they stick into you. You know, it's right through your Lycra gear and into your socks, and they're real beasts. And then I'd say that the other part of it is just what's beautiful about it is the large expanse of it all, but it's also one of the horrible things, because you feel I am so alone. This is so far to the next place, even though you know there's a roadhouse. Unlike the original overlanders, they didn't know what was in front of them.
One of the nights that you were riding across the Nullarbor, Rupert, you saw these dark clumps on the side of the road. What did you think they were?
Yeah, well, bear in mind, so I was having a bad day. My mind was sort of playing games with me on that day. I had a bad day. I had a couple of punctures, and I'd gone through emotional highs and lows. And you know, we're getting to the late in the evening, and it was windy, and it was raining. You know, last year's race we had quite a lot of rain, funnily enough, in the desert, which was kind of weird. But it was dark, and I was sore all over, from knees to elbows and shoulders. And anyway, I was going about 16 kilometres per hour. Anyway, I just wanted to lie down and stop. And then it was on the road to Mundrabilla, and I saw on the left and the right, I started noticing these big clumps. And I thought, oh, maybe they're just, cow pads, the cow pads. But
not so many cows in the desert.
No, they hadn't seen a cow. I didn't see a cow the whole. You wouldn't see a cow out there. But I remember my brain telling me, oh, there must be cow pads or something. You know, but anyway, I didn't stop to, I finally made it to Mundrabilla, but I was absolutely busted. And it wasn't my longest day, but it was my hardest day on a bike. And I still think to this day it was about 276 kilometres or 86 kilometres. Anyway, so I was in this hotel room with about three or four other guys, because often we'd share the cost of a room. And then one of the other guys who I saw a lot of, a guy called Hugh Moore, Humongous Hugh, his name, nickname was, he said, oh, no, he told me, he said, they were death adders, curled up death adders.
What?
Yeah.
Snakes curled up.
Yeah, because what had happened, because they'd been raining, and it was still quite warm, but for the death adders, it was a bit like a group spa bath or a sauna. They came out and got warm on the bitumen of the road. And so they were curled up in these big clumps.
Rupert.
And then I saw some, dead ones the next day, and they thought, oh, my God.
Would have been enough to make me turn around and ride all the way back to Fremantle, I think. But so you made it to cross the halfway mark, which must have felt amazing, and then cycled into Adelaide. What was it like to be back in a city after all that desert?
That was really weird, and again, it was an experience I didn't really sort of, because you haven't had that experience before, you don't know. And then finally come back into Adelaide. One, getting used to sort of the increasing build-up of traffic and roads and road signs and stuff, and then obviously two, people. And then I remember once we got into Adelaide, stopping at a lights, because it was peak hour, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was going to go to this bike shop, Treadley Bikes, to get my bike serviced. And I remember stopping at a intersection, and then I remember seeing people in nice, neat clothes with going to work, and I thought, God, I'm a stink. I was such the opposite, And that was it was quite a weird experience. And then one of the dot trackers being people who sort of follow you, and then they would come out and see you on the road. And this dot tracker, Kay Hasmer, she guided me in, to find the shop. And then so I went to the shop, obviously. But it was quite a weird experience suddenly confronting those. I mean, I remember earlier in Sejuna, there was a traffic light there. And I remember thinking, something in my brain was working slowly, and I'm thinking, traffic light, okay, red, stop, orange. I had to sort of reacquaint with what you had to do with a traffic light. So obviously fatigue's setting in at this point too. So those simple things we do in the city, suddenly you've had to recalibrate your senses.
When you were in that bike shop in Treadley Bikes in Adelaide, what news did you hear?
Well, it was, it was a turning point for everybody, I was in such a state of sort of happiness to begin with, because I sort of just had got my head around, my body in mind around, you know, this whole journey of how hard it was going to be. But I was really looking forward to getting out on the isolated roads again. Originally, I was going to treat myself to a rest day in a nice hotel and wine and dine for a day, But by the time I reached there, my mind was about, for me now, the luxury is the isolation, the wilderness, get out of the city, Anyway, but I was in a good frame of mind, and then just getting my bike, talking to the mechanic, and then I've mentioned Kay Harsmer. She left, and then she came back again. She had a different look on her face, and she said, have you heard the news? And myself and the mechanic looked at each other. We obviously hadn't. And she said, apparently someone's, been killed. And she had, a wire report that she printed out saying that there'd been a tragic accident south of Canberra.
And how did you realise who it was?
Well, we didn't officially know, but the fact was that where they gave the specifics of on the Monaro Highway just south of Canberra with an accident, and then the only IndyPack rider there, and his dot was Mike Hall's dot. So it was obviously easy to figure out, but it wasn't official. So it was obviously a major blow and a shock. And then,
what reaction was there in the bike shop?
I was talking about silence before in the desert. Probably that was the most silent moment since being in the desert, because no one knew. First, there's that instant shock, and then there's that sense of, well, it's not official yet, but you know, in the back of your mind, that's where Mike's dot stopped at 6:22. And so it's like this, no one wants to jump the gun and say who it is, definitely, but you know who it is. And so you're sort of wrestling with those emotions, and then...
Someone gave you a hug in that shop.
Yeah, that was, it was like, by this point, I contacted my wife, Libby. I called her and I had trouble getting hold of her first, but because I wanted her to know that I'm okay. But then she was naturally distressed as well. She was with a friend of hers at a cafe in Sydney, and she was distressed and in tears, and I was too. And then I'd made this mind that, look, I'm going to come home. I can't put her through this the anxiety of following a dot and wondering whether is my dot stopping because I'm stopping for a natural break, or have something happened like what happened to Mike Hall. Anyway, by the time I said I'm coming home, then I was told the race is officially cancelled anyway. And then I came back into the shop from the cafe where I was. It was right, they were right next to each other. I came back into the shop, and I just, this guy who, he just asked me, I didn't know him, he just asked me, he said, are you okay? And I just said, I said, no. I said, it's awful. I just collapsed into his arms, and, just burst into tears. He gave me this hug, which was, I don't know, it was like I'd never felt a hug like that in my life. Except for my wife, obviously. Sorry, Olivia, didn't mean that.
A different sort of hug.
And somehow it was like sort of the hug you needed to sort of get yourself back. And also I glanced up and I saw his wife, and she had the same reassuring look. And it's Paul Brooks and Catherine Seal Yates, and bless their souls, because they were there at the right time, it just helped me regather enough strength to go off and do my stuff with my bike, and I had a shower. And then I came back, and I remember I saw the guy at the shop who ran the shop, Sam, and I said, who are those people? I wanted to say thanks, And they said, look, they left. I went, I didn't even get a chance to say thanks, And I just felt sort of awful about that. And then months later, Catherine, she sent me a Facebook message saying, you remember that bloke who gave you a hug? Oh, that's my husband, Paul. He's a paramedic, and he works he's a first responder in these crises. And his actual particular skill, besides what skills he has as a paramedic, is also to be helping the sufferers of trauma who are at accident sites, someone's had an awful accident, but the person who's there with them, he's the person who sort of looks after the person there. And Catherine, she's a firefighter, so you think, wow, trail angels, you don't get better than those two. And thankful for them being there.
So you stopped the race and you came back to your wife in in Sydney, and I guess life returned to normal to a degree. It was announced this year that the race would run again. What did you do?
Yeah, it was because I didn't regret stopping in Adelaide. I was 100%, you know, some people still continued. Everyone had their, you know, reasons for continuing or not. There was no right or wrong. But certainly as time passed and then you start, I did sort of start to lament not having finished, because I went to some of the, when I went to the Opera House in Sydney to see some of the people who finished, and obviously then you start thinking, oh my God, you know, the look of satisfaction on their faces for finishing it was fantastic. And I thought, gee, I'd love, you know, it just got into my craw and I just wanted to experience that as well. So I had to try and admit to Libby that I still want to do it again.
What did she think about that?
I don't think she thought I was serious at first, but I do remember thinking, look, I'm not going to press the subject, just going to, bring it up in discussion gradually, you know. And I think one of the things I tried to do, and I hope she sees this, but it was, try and, instead of making it a, it's a subject that could have gone two ways. It could have gone, oh, I'm doing this. No, you're not. I'm doing it. No, you're not. Something like that, you know, and then that doesn't get anybody anywhere. So I tried, my thinking was to try and raise it and then just let her sort of try and hopefully get her head around the possibility of me doing it, or the fact that I'm interested, because it doesn't change my training. I'm still riding and stuff. And then hopefully for her to, I sort of said, like, if you've got, with this issue, any safety issues, whatever issues you have about it, just put them on the table and we'll go through them one by one, because it's only for the best solution.
And Libby came round, you did it.
Yes.
How different was it second time?
Oh, well, it was fabulous. I mean, the first one was fabulous too, because it was so new, it was so fresh, and even though I tripped up and everything in certain places, but I didn't think, nothing's a failure, because it's a new experience. That's what, it's a positive, doing something you haven't done. Doing the second time, I thought, I'm going to really, one, I really appreciated having a second opportunity to do it. Two, I really absolutely, appreciated how much Libby still supported me, even though it was very tense leading into the actual start. But I think it was something which, I'll be forever indebted to for a support on that.
Did you get to dip your front wheel in the Pacific?
I did.
You finished?
I did. I finished it.
Congratulations. Thank you for being my guest on Conversations, Rupert.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Rupert Guinness's book is called Overlander. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.